I think maybe it's worth thinking like a criminal and understanding how thinking like a criminal is different to thinking like a different type of enterprise. The reason I enjoy thinking about organised crime and covering organised crime is because it's organised. You know, these are networks, as you say, of professional organised people. But they're not out to win customers. They're not like Microsoft and Google who want to come out with innovation and innovative new products to win, you know, customers from their competition. No, they want to make money from victims. And frankly, as long as you're making enough money from your victims month in, month out, you don't change. There's no reason to innovate. Crime gangs innovate when law enforcement and the force of authority stop them from making the money they usually make. That's when you innovate.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve speaks with investigative tech journalist Jeff White, who has covered tech and financial crime for more than 20 years. Listeners may be familiar with his popular podcast, The Lazarus Heist, for the BBC World Service. His new book, Rinsed, From Cartels to Crypto, How the Tech Industry Washes Money for the World's Deadliest Crooks, from Penguin Random House, releases June 13th. Steve and Jeff discuss current trends in organized cybercrime, how these criminals are, or maybe aren't, adopting AI, and the difficulties law enforcement still faces in helping the victims of these crimes.
Jeff, lovely to see you. Thanks very much for joining me today on the podcast. You've been looking at the whole area of technology and organized crime for quite some while. You know, cyber, crypto, financial, the whole gamut. Probably a good idea for our listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with you, not familiar with things like The Lazarus Heist and some of the other books and podcasts that you've produced, if you could just give a bit of a background on how you came to get involved in this. It's a really fascinating subject, I think. But be good to give people that feel for why you came to it and what your interest is.
Yeah, it's a very good question. So I started out, I've been a journalist for quite some time, and I was at Channel 4 News covering technology for the program. And the way TV news works is you've got a certain amount of time, a very limited amount of time. I mean, Channel 4 News, it is a long program, 50 minutes. It's a good program, but fundamentally, once you reach the end of 50 minutes, that's it. The screen goes to credits and that's that. So if you're higher up in the program, you survive. But if you're lower down in the program, the danger is news happens higher up in the program and you get dropped off the end, so to speak.
Right.
And what I found being a technology journalist was that the stories we were doing tended to get dropped off because at the time it was the sort of Apple podcast launches and iPods and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I thought, well, we need to kind of do hard news to get higher up in the program. You know, if you're hard news, if you're chunky, important, hard-hitting stories, you go higher up in the running order and you survive. So it's basically a sort of survival tactic. But then I started seeing, you know, cybercrime was starting to become something that's very prevalent in the news. We saw the anonymous hacks, we saw the Snowden leaks and so on. And so suddenly this issue of cybercrime and of online wrongdoing just went up and up and up in the running order and became more and more important. And that's when I decided that, you know, the part of technology that I was really interested in was that sort of murky wrongdoing kind of organized crime kind of element.
And as you mentioned there, you know, you were involved in the Snowden instance. You've looked at things like the TalkTalk breach. You've been involved in the major cybercrime incidents, if you like, over the last few years. What have you actually learned from studying those particular incidents? You know, how have things evolved? How have they changed?
Frankly, the first lesson you learn is watch out for dodgy emails. It's depressing that even now in 2024, look, the hacks get more complicated. The hackers get certainly more astute and better, but it is sort of depressing that still in 2024, the way in for so many of these hacks, no matter how complicated they get thereafter, is phishing. I should say phishing messages now. LinkedIn's being used a bit more and WhatsApp's being used a bit more. But what's been really interesting is sort of sea change over the time I've been covering it of how the issue is regarded, how cybercrime is regarded, how seriously it's taken, how different news organizations have covered it and taken it really, really seriously. The other thing that's been really interesting was when I first started covering it, finding victims of cybercrime was really difficult. Didn't tend to happen. And also attribution of cybercrimes to any, even a country, let alone an individual, very rarely happened. So you had, you know, it's really frustrating as a journalist, you had in a way the ultimate victimless crime or apparently victimless crime. You couldn't find any victims to speak. And even when they did, you didn't know who did it. It was this mysterious crime. That has absolutely changed. We have attribution now, a lot more attribution. And you know, victims are coming forward sometimes to tell their story sort of willingly, but also on the darker side of that, sometimes being outed and publicly almost shamed as victims of cybercrime as part of the criminal's tactics. So that victim-villain part of the piece has completely changed. And that's another reason why it sort of surged up the running order and surged into the headlines.
Yeah, and we've seen as well a lot more sort of nation-state-backed incident there, haven't we, as well? Tell us a little bit about that. How's that evolved?
Yeah, well, it's been really interesting. Look, I mean, nation states have always used espionage. That's as old as probably nations themselves are. Yeah. As stuff shifted online, as information shifted online, inevitably a lot of that espionage work and also propaganda has just shifted online. And obviously, we'll talk about disinformation at the moment. There are new forms of disinformation, but there's also just old-fashioned propaganda that we've had for quite a long time. What's been interesting has been to see nation states starting to adopt and adapt tactics that are used by, for example, organized crime gangs. So we'll probably talk about this, but I've done a lot of stuff on North Korean suspected hacking. And one of the things about North Korea is it's run out of money. It's under sanctions. They're after cold, hard currency. And so the North Koreans have often adopted the tactics and sometimes the tools of organized cybercrime gangs. Nation states have also learned from hacktivists, from leaks, from people like WikiLeaks and from Anonymous. They've learned the damage that a leak can do, a leak of information can do. And that's fed into that disinformation piece. Nation states are now extremely astute at getting in, stealing information, and then weaponizing that information to change elections, to change people's attitudes, to influence world events. So yeah, nation states have got both feet in to this cybercrime game.
So if we look at the, you know, major constituent parts of cybercrime, if you like, obviously at the more perhaps sophisticated end, you might have, as you just said, from an espionage standpoint, we've got the nation states, we've got organized crime that has clearly seen there's a massive opportunity in that. And then we've also got the individual hackers and hacker groups, hacktivists and so on. How are you seeing the evolution in each of those different areas? Are we seeing them, for instance, you know, are we seeing a mad rush towards the use of artificial intelligence in that space, or a reversion perhaps to some of the more traditional? You mentioned phishing there. You know, we've seen very much a development of crime as a service, where you can go on the dark web, you can buy whatever it is that you choose with money-back guarantees, 24-hour help desks, all of that kind of thing. So a maturing of the industry, if you like, from that standpoint. But what else are you seeing in that?
Well, it's interesting. I think there's flow of influence in two ways. In terms of the triumvirate that you've mapped out there very astutely, I think that's right. Nation state, cybercrime, sort of hacktivist, you could put in inverted commas, lower level, if you like. Certainly in terms of skill, not necessarily only in terms of impact. In terms of the amount of time and effort and skill and aptitude and, if you like, weapon weight, obviously nation states are going to win. These are people who are paid by governments to turn up Monday to Friday, nine to six, if not more hours, you know, doing this stuff all the time. They will develop the most potent cyber weapons. What we've seen, though, is those weapons trickling down and the use of those weapons and those tools trickling down, most notably the, you know, famously the WannaCry cyber attack back in 2017, where cyber weapons developed apparently by the United States government end up in the hands of cybercrime gangs and are weaponized in that way. I think government's going to struggle to hang on to those weapons and not let them leak out. And then eventually, of course, those weapons and those vulnerabilities and those tools get down to even the lowest level. So even, you know, people who hang out on hack forums can start to get hold of some of these tools and use them. But what's been interesting is watching in another direction, the flow of techniques flow the other way, because the hacktivists, yes, they may not have, you know, the expensive multi-million zero-day government tools that the government hackers have, but the hacktivists know absolutely how to drag a company's name through the mud. They know absolutely how to play the influence game. And that knowledge, that information sharing, that ability has flown upwards from the hacktivists up into organized crime gangs and up into government. So you're starting to see, in the case of ransomware gangs, they are weaponizing stolen data to force victims to pay ransoms. You know, you have these leak sites where stolen data is leaked in order to put the stiffeners onto victims of ransomware to get them to pay the ransom. Well, that's a tactic taken out partly from the hacktivist playbook. Embarrass your victim, get them to play ball. So we're seeing techniques and tactics and tools sort of drift downwards from heavier players to lower levels. But we're seeing the tactics kind of spread out from the lower levels back up. It's a really sort of fascinating mix. In terms of AI, would you mention that? And I have to say, Steve, I've fallen totally into your trap of AI coverage. Whenever you have to do one on AI, I love those. I'm trying to absorb as much as I can, like a lot of people. I will say at the moment that, and I think this is fair enough, I think I've heard a few people say this, that the AI running, the momentum, I think, is with the defenders at the moment. Cybersecurity companies have been using AI for a long time, anti-financial crime as well, using AI to spot suspicious patterns, suspicious emails and malware and so on. Yes, it's being used by criminal gangs. We've seen that. But I haven't as yet, as far as I'm aware, seen anything at scale, you know, certainly on the scale of ransomware, where AI is being weaponized in that sort of mass way. Yes, cyber criminals are experimenting with AI, but I don't feel there's a dangerous AI weapon that has been unleashed as yet. Maybe that's yet to happen. I don't know. One option is, hey, they're making enough money out of just sending phishing emails and phishing messages. Do you need AI to help out necessarily? So we'll see where things go.
Yeah, I know. And when I think about it, that probably is something that does bother me. It's they're a little bit too quiet for me. And it could be that, as you just say, you know, they're making so much money out of the more traditional stuff. Well, stick to the knitting. There's no need to do anything more complicated. But I do just wonder whether we aren't suddenly going to be hit one day with, because, you know, they have R&D labs, as you know, and I can't help but think that there are a bunch of very intelligent people somewhere who are using the same kinds of tools as the good guys. And that one day we aren't going to suddenly be hit with something that hopefully not of a scale of a WannaCry or something like that. But it does worry me a little bit. I'm sure that, you know, I'm trusting that law enforcement and others are on top of it and keep an eye on that kind of thing. But yeah, that's something that does worry me a little.
It's interesting that, and I think maybe it's worth thinking like a criminal and understanding how thinking like a criminal is different to thinking like a different type of enterprise. The reason I enjoy thinking about organized crime and covering organized crime is because it's organized. You know, these are networks, as you say, of professional, organized people, but they're not out to win customers. They're not like Microsoft and Google, who want to come out with innovation and innovative new products to win, you know, customers from their competition. No, they want to make money from victims. And frankly, as long as you're making enough money from your victims month in, month out, you don't change. There's no reason to innovate. Crime gangs innovate when law enforcement and the force of authority stop them from making the money they usually make. That's when you innovate. You innovate because you're forced to. Frankly, if these criminals weren't lazy, they wouldn't be criminals. You know, if you're making lots of money out of doing what you're doing, you just keep doing it. And so what will be interesting to see is when the AI level gets to the point where it does serious damage to the criminal enterprises, then I think they innovate. They may strike back. But again, will they strike back with AI? Does the adversary need its own AI to take on the defender's AI? Not necessarily. What I need to understand as an offender, as a criminal organization, is the weaknesses in your defensive AI. If I can get around them, I'm in. That's fine. Yep. You know, you need to defend every kind of portal, every kind of server, every kind of system. All I need to find is the way in around it. So I'm not necessarily going to develop my own AI as an adversary, but I'm going to be very interested in how your AI works because I know there's a hole in it somewhere. And as soon as I find it, I'm in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, let's talk about your latest book, because very, very kindly, I think your publishers gave me a pre-published copy of that. So I've had a read of it. It's called Rinsed. I believe it's out in a couple of months' time. So it's out in June.
Yes, right.
And in that, you dig into a lot more about some of the things we've just touched on here in terms of the way that organized crime groups might be, you know, teaming up with cyber criminals in ways we haven't perhaps seen before. You touch on things like how technology is enabling the financial aspects of cybercrime, because as you've just said, you know, it's all about making money. But tell us a bit more about Rinsed. What was the driver behind that? What's different about it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So I'd covered North Korean cybercrime for quite a while. I'd done a podcast called The Lazarus Heist for the BBC World Service. I wrote the book as well. Of that series. And I think I realized that when I started out covering cybercrime, I think I had the idea that quite a lot of people in the general public have, that cybercriminals have sort of godlike powers and they type in a few lines of code into a keyboard and that's it, your money is gone. And inevitably, the picture turned out to be a lot more nuanced than that. And covering North Korean cybercrime was really interesting because North Korea's hackers are, like a lot of computer hackers, very good at breaking in. They can get into places very, very easily, it seems to me, sending phishing messages. And then they can sniff their way around networks. They can understand how these networks work. That's all fine. And they can get their, if you like, their digital hands on the money. But then there's a question of, well, what do you do with it next?
Right.
You know, do you send it to Kim Jong-un's bank account? Well, no, obviously not. You don't. So what you need is places and ways to put that money, to extricate it, to hide it, disguise it. And that's not really necessarily the hacker's skill set. They understand servers and code and vulnerabilities, but bank account creation, international finance, cryptocurrency, these aren't necessarily things that hackers understand. There's a whole other set, as far as I can work out, of criminals who are still technologically enabled. They're technically skilled, but are skilled in the financial crime way. So once you've hacked in and you've got your hands digitally on the money, it's this group of people who are going to say to you, right, send it here, we'll ship it there, we'll put it there, we'll transfer it here, swap it through crypto, mix it up, and then we'll exit back to you minus our cut. This is money laundering. And technology is now playing a huge role in money laundering, of course, because money's become digitized. As money becomes digitized, you need technologically savvy people to help you launder that money. And obviously, those people have served cyber criminals for a long time. What's interesting now is traditional crime gangs, you're talking about street level drug dealers, prostitution rings, are realizing that they can put their cash money into digital form, into perhaps crypto form, and use this same network of money launderers to help them escape with the money. That's been the big trend, is more and more crime gangs of all stripes using these technologically savvy money launderers.
And as you say, it's been a bit of an evolution, but how effective has been the response of law enforcement in really trying to combat this? Because traditionally, government, public sector, law enforcement in particular, have always struggled to try to keep up, you know, to keep pace.
That's certainly true. It is still true. However, I think there was a time when, frankly, explaining Bitcoin to sort of rank and file police officers was a struggle. I think those days are gone. I think most police officers have realized that cryptocurrency, particularly as these street level gangs and as more and more criminals have got into it, there's been this realization that things like cryptocurrency is something that law enforcement needs to be on top of. There are increasing amounts of tools that you can use to sort of trace these transactions, because as a lot of people know, cryptocurrency is unique in a way in that the exchanges of cryptocurrency between individuals is all publicly recorded on blockchains, on public ledgers. Mm. The names of the individuals, not necessarily, but their wallet IDs, if you like, their bank accounts in inverted commas. So that's all traceable. So there's tremendous potential for law enforcement to be able to track this stuff down and stay ahead of the game. The problem is volume. If you're a police force and you have many, many, many victims losing money here, there, and everywhere in the form of cryptocurrency, how many of those cases are you going to trace down? How much resource do you have? And for the victim who lost £500, is that worth doing when you've got a local business who's maybe lost £1.5 million? Where do you put your priorities? And I have to say, frankly, if you're losing those smaller amounts of money, relatively small amounts of money as an individual, it could be that law enforcement just don't have the resources to help you out. So it's a really mixed picture. It's not the law enforcement being left in the dust. They are trying to catch up, but they only have a certain amount of horsepower to get ahead of the criminals.
Mm. And one of the things certainly about cybercrime is that, of course, it is a global business. It's very much international, isn't it? You've made the point about crypto and about the way in which money moves around the world. One of the challenges, again, that law enforcement has traditionally had is trying to operate cross-border. Mm. You know, I remember talking to some law enforcement agencies not that long ago who were still expressing, you know, frustration at the fact that they could pinpoint where some of this activity was taking place, but for a variety of reasons, were unable to do anything about it. And the host nation, if I could put it that way, were not being particularly helpful.
Yeah.
Is that something as well that you've seen in here that you think is still hampering the progress?
In terms of getting individuals in handcuffs, yes. Inevitably, if you're a criminal and you're smart, you base yourself in a jurisdiction that does not have an extradition agreement with the people, the victims that you're targeting. That's sort of lesson one, if you like, in trying to commit online crimes. That is still absolutely the case. So yeah, getting people in handcuffs might not be possible. In terms of tracing the money, catching the money and taking down the infrastructure and so on, it's a mixed picture, because a lot of these new high-tech forms of finance, cryptocurrency, new online banking operations, they operate internationally. They want to scale globally. So they tend to have an international footprint. So yes, the person committing the crime may be in, you know, a jurisdiction where there's no chance of extradition, you know, Russian Federation being the obvious example. But the infrastructure that they used, you know, the cryptocurrency companies, maybe the online banks, the bank accounts, the servers, they're distributed all over the world. There may be international companies. So you might be able to get in touch with them, and they might have a sort of international presence, if you like, that you can rely on no matter which country you come from. Sometimes. But again, if you're a smart criminal, you know that. And you think, right, if I take my stolen money to Bank X, I know that Bank X is friendly with the police force in the country of the victims that I'm targeting. So I'm going to put my money into Bank Y, which is in a jurisdiction somewhere where they don't really play ball or where it's very opaque. And again, the technologically savvy money launderers will help you with that. If you don't know how that works, you don't know which banks to use, they'll say, don't put your money through that bank, because, you know, they'll get a subpoena and they'll get it frozen or get a warrant. Go through this bank over here, because we've used them before. And we know that they don't play ball with law enforcement. So there's a sort of game going on in terms of trying to avoid those international tentacles of law enforcement.
So what's your perspective on the future in this space? How do you think that the whole sort of cybercrime, crypto, you know, law enforcement landscape is likely to change over the next 12 to 18 months?
That's a really interesting question. And it depends how sort of wide you want to go. There are constant noises from governments saying, we want to embrace this new world. British government constantly coming out with positive noises about crypto in sort of press conferences, and ministerial speeches are hilarious. You can almost generate them from ChatGPT. Oh, you know, we love the wonderful new world that might spring from these financial innovations, but, you know, we have to be wary of the challenges. It's just, it's written, you know, in ministerial speech speak. So, you know, governments are trying to sort of pursue this. And obviously part of that is they understand there's criminality in cryptocurrency. In a way, that's not surprising, you know, there's criminality in currency of all types. So the question is, can we damp down those weeds? Can we get it to the point where the wrongdoing is low enough that people trust this stuff? You've also got, in addition to government work, you've got traditional finance coming in. So recently there's been a new exchange traded fund set up for cryptocurrency, for Bitcoin. I don't know really what an exchange traded fund is. All I know is it's a traditional finance thing, and people who would never have normally got into cryptocurrency and Bitcoin can now invest in it through this ETF thing. That's going to increase people's confidence, I think, in crypto. That's going to make it seem a little less Wild West. But also, right, it's going to increase the volume, the amount of crypto trading. And what money launderers like is volume. They like lots of transactions being done so they can hide their criminal flows of money. So as cryptocurrency gets larger, as more financial institutions get behind it, as governments get behind it, yes, it can make it more legitimate. It can expand the legitimacy of it, but it also creates more noise, if you like, for the criminals to hide in. So it'd be really interesting to see how things go. Yeah, it's going to be a fascinating sort of area for the next, certainly 12 to 18 months is a good timeline to look out on.
And presumably you're going to keep on watching, you're going to keep on bringing stories to us and doing your investigative work and trying to shine a light on some of the things that are going on there that inform the rest of us as to how we should perhaps avoid some of those pitfalls. So Jeff, been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much for taking the time. I think, you know, a really good perspective there on the way in which organized crime is evolving, cybercrime, crypto, and indeed some insights there into things that are going on perhaps people wouldn't necessarily have known. So thank you very much indeed for sharing those.
Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Our thanks to this week's guest, Jeff White. We'll be back next week with a new episode. If you found value in the conversation today, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.